Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People, where our goal is to look beyond the superficial and reveal the essence, to explore hidden dimensions of life's challenges, and discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit on both the individual as well as the collective level. Often here on this show, we focus upon the importance in our healing, in our health, and in our wellness, the importance of making the right choices. And this is what we're doing in every moment. We're choosing. At the most momentary level, we're choosing what thought to allow to enter our mind or stay in our mind. Our way of thinking and the things that we focus on are to a very large extent those things that we've been trained to focus on and to think about things in the way we've been taught to think about things. What we also focus on a lot in this show is that a lot of the information that we've been given, the information that guided our development as children, the information that surrounds us every day that comes at us from the media, from the government, from our internet, that so much of this is untrue. When we talk with Dr. Hayes Roth about truthiness fever, we looked at the fact that we basically live in a polluted information environment. A huge amount of what comes at us is untrue, and it's not helpful to us. So I can remember back as a young physician, it was quite obvious that cigarettes caused emphysema and that they predisposed us to having lung cancer. And yet the official word was that we haven't proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that cigarettes cause lung cancer. And I watched over a period of about 12 years, during which time some 80 or 90,000 people died of lung cancer and smoking-related diseases just before the government was willing to say cigarettes are bad for your health. And then we had the food pyramid that is almost guaranteed to produce the kind of illness that we have. And so what we see, we live in a world where we're all making really rotten choices. And we're making that at the societal level. As Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges said, we now live in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, governments destroy freedom, the press destroys information, and religion destroys morals, while our banks destroy the economy. So we live in this kind of topsy-turvy world where the human spirit comes into this world seeking love, but instead it finds something else. It finds danger, it finds pain, it finds lies. And that results to a damage to the spirit that we see in our physical illnesses, we see in our emotional imbalances, and we see in the foolish choices that we're making as a culture. I've spent a lot of my life trying to understand how this happens and to help people see beyond some of the myths and distortions that keep us sick and unwell. And I'm here today with my good friend, Dr. John Travis, better known as Jack, who's both a physician and has earned a Master's of Public Health degree. Is also known as one of the people who brought wellness to the fore back in the 70s. Welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People, Jack.
Thank you, Emmett.
I've always seen you as a kindred spirit in that, you know, much of your work has been to help people see beyond the distortion, help people see a different way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the main things you brought forward that I've found so useful in my work is the difference between the treatment perspective and the wellness perspective. Can you say a little bit about what that is? When you say wellness, as one of the people who crafted the original concepts, what do you mean by wellness?
Well, I see two different paradigms. The classical treatment paradigm, which is fixing problems, the allopathic model, or many holistic models are still focused on fixing a problem. And I graphically illustrate that with what I call the illness-wellness continuum. It's a double-headed arrow with a neutral point in the middle. And on the left side, at the extreme, is premature death. And as you move to the center, it goes from disability or disability symptoms and signs as things get less, signs are what doctors can detect but the patient isn't aware of, till you reach the point of no definable problem. And then moving to the right towards high-level wellness, you have education, awareness, and growth, or awareness, education, and growth. Mm-hmm. The wellness paradigm works on both sides of the continuum. You often require a disease or a problem to motivate you to think about it. And in conjunction with working with the treatment model, you can learn more about how you got sick and how you can prevent it in the future. But it can continue past the neutral point because there's nothing left to treat, but there's a lot more you can learn about yourself and expand and experience higher levels of wellness. Mm-hmm. So those two paradigms work side by side. One's focused on fixing. The other is focused on expanding your awareness and becoming more conscious and also becoming more connected. I think the bottom line of all my work after 40 years is one sentence: the currency of wellness is connection. And everything I've done is basically around looking at connection, how we're connected with our food, we're connected with our bodies, we're connected with the air we breathe, we're connected with our feelings, our thoughts, our communications, our sense of meaning, all those things. So connection is the core idea.
Well, since we're all connected to those things, what does that have to do with wellness?
Well, we're not that well connected. Mm. Many men are not connected to their feelings. Mm-hmm. Women tend to be less connected to their thoughts. Mm-hmm. None of us are very well connected to our communications in this culture. Most of us aren't connected with our breathing. We breathe unconsciously, shallowly, so forth. Many people aren't connected with the food they eat. They eat high calorie, refined carbohydrates. They have no connection with their sense of meaning in the world. All of these things require some consciousness to really be connected with them.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean to be connected? I mean, after all, everybody breathes. Aren't we connected with our breathing? Or everybody thinks or feels?
Well, feeling, you can have feelings and not be aware of them and project them onto other people. Or you can be breathing unconsciously and be tense and short, shallow breathing. If you learn how to take deep breaths and regular breaths, it can change your whole consciousness. Mm-hmm. But people who aren't connected to their breathing are unconscious, and it's a method of keeping themselves insulated from their feelings, sort of a self-medication. You lower your awareness, your sensitivity, same way as carrying a lot of fat dims your or dulls your feelings in your body. It's like a protection, an armoring.
Mm-hmm. So wellness has to do with consciousness and awareness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by doing these things that we sort of do, we do poorly, but by doing them with awareness, we can bring something to the experience.
That's the connection, yeah.
Yeah. And that's how we make connection with it. And as a result of that connection, then we begin to get positive feelings inside, more physical energy?
Mm-hmm. Or even negative feelings. But if you're aware of them and you allow them to flow through you rather than suppress them, and which locks them into your body, into muscle groups or pain, and there's all kinds of things we can do with feelings that aren't healthy. But if we allow them to flow through us, it's energy. And that energy is then freed up to move on. Mm-hmm. So probably the biggest thing we're not connected with is the connections with other people and the dominator approach to life of trying to power over people, that kind of connection, which is an overpowering, unbalanced connection, leads to the whole cultural situation that we've got of a world that's destroying itself. Doctors who make people sick and lawyers who erode justice, the quote that you gave of mm-hmm. Chris Hedges.
I often talk about that same quality that you're referring to as connection, or having a sort of balanced relationship,
mm-hmm.
Is the essence of life, what life is, at least in my model. Life is about coming together, so it could be atoms coming together to form these large organic molecules, or molecules coming together to forming a cell, and cells coming together with other cells and creating a kind of connection, a kind of way of working together, or like dancing together, you know, mm-hmm. doing a step that fits, and that that process of healing, which is different from the treatment model. Also, it's interesting how there's a parallel that
you treat symptoms, but you heal underlying pathology.
That's right.
And we've gotten those confused.
Right. And the symptom is there. The symptom would not have been there if we had made other choices.
Mm-hmm. And the symptom's the message telling us there's something we're not doing.
So let's take a look at the choices that we're making.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the choices that we're making are poor choices because of the myths that we've been told. Some of the food pyramid, or maybe cigarettes don't cause cancer, or maybe there's no such thing as global warming. I mean, the kinds of things mm-hmm. that we're led to believe, and then we end up making these poor. And then there are the implicit decisions, the beliefs that we've downloaded from the culture as children,
mm-hmm.
That sort of block us from seeing that beautiful spirit that we are
mm-hmm.
at the center. And the process of healing has to do with, in a sense, bringing in information that allows you to see beyond these limits. And so when I'm working with someone who comes to see me with a symptom of pain or with a symptom of wanting to perform at a higher level, there is that process of helping to create greater connection. Without that, we get people who are ill at many different levels. And one of the ways that I think that has been dear to your heart that people have been injured is through that practice of circumcision, and mm-hmm. that we've always said, oh, it's just a baby and they don't feel it. I mean, unless you've been there for a few circumcisions,
yeah.
and then you have the feeling that, ooh, that baby actually does feel it. And yet everybody's saying, oh, it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us a little bit about
created three sexes. We have women, intact men, and altered men who've lost lost three quarters of their fine touch sensitivity nerve system. I like to ask the riddle, why do women fake orgasm? And the answer is because men fake
foreplay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do men fake foreplay? Because they don't have the equipment to enjoy it with.
Uh-huh.
Basically, they're left with an on-off switch. They don't have any of the fine range, all the subtle feelings. It's like the difference uh-huh. between the 1812 overture and the Sibelius second symphony, second movement, all the subtle, intricate, slow buildup that the foreskin provides.
Mm-hmm.
The foreskin is the most sensitive part of the penis and very well designed. And both you lose that sensory apparatus. Plus, with a baby, you've created a trauma of his first sexual experience is painful. And it's not just the operation itself, but the days and weeks afterwards when every time he pees, he's got a raw wound there. And the myth that babies didn't feel pain, which they finally, they were doing open heart surgery without anesthesia on babies because they didn't have myelin, so they can't feel pain. Well, the nurses knew that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a dual thing of the later dysfunction and the trauma of the experience. And then you have a small group of people trying to prove, to justify it. It's a $2 billion a year industry in the U.S. The only...
You think money has something to do with it?
Oh, yeah, follow the money. When it's ended, like in Britain in 1948, when they didn't fund it with their National Health Service, dropped to like 5%. And Australia, in the 70s, it dropped from about 80% to 12 or 13%, even lower in New Zealand and South Africa and Canada. But Americans are clueless that they're the only country that does this to their boys. And it's interesting that the three circumcising cultures are the ones that are most at war right now. The war of the circumcised, the Arabs, the Jews, and the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And is there some similarity or coincidence here? I don't know.
What do you think? You think that kind of trauma to a child might produce
something? Definitely produces a more violent look towards life, of experiencing violence, a sense of betrayal from the mother that didn't protect the boy. And now for all of those mothers and fathers who are feeling guilty that they didn't know any better, I want to just clarify that difference between guilt and regret, that if my first child had been a boy, I would have circumcised her. I knew better by the second one, 21 years later. Guilt is when you knew something but went ahead and did it anyway. Regret is when you didn't know something and that you would do differently now. So I just want to clarify that. Many of the things that I wish I'd known when I was younger that I've discovered now, I have regrets about, but I don't feel guilty because...
Well, guilt is a kind of a denial. Guilt is a way to avoid feeling sadness, of feeling loss, and of having to say, I really regret what happened, and I know nothing. Guilt, almost as if you could go back and redo it. You get angry. Maybe if you get angry enough at yourself, it'll be undone. You know, it's a sort of magical thinking kind of thing.
Guilt, the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. And what sort of experiments have been done showing what sort of issues come up for men later on?
Well, very few, because there's no funding for it. There have been three studies in Africa that are highly touted that purport to show a protective effect for HIV. One of them actually showed that it was a negative effect for women, that more women were getting HIV from circumcised men. There were so many flaws in the studies that they should never have been published. And we've published the refutation of it, but it's like become a meme. And there's a very strong lobby of people promoting circumcision that have gotten the ear of people at CDC and UNAIDS. So it's like this cultural myth that it's so upsetting to think that we've done something that we shouldn't have done, that people are in denial about it, and the extremists are trying to justify it even further. It's considered a procedure in search of a disease, or a cure in search of a disease, from masturbation, which was the original intent in the late 1800s, to stop masturbation, which it doesn't do, to preventing insanity. I mean, there's a list of 50 different things that circumcision is supposed to have prevented, and the latest one is HIV/AIDS. And again, it doesn't hold water. When you factor in other factors, it just doesn't hold up. Mm-hmm. So that's been, and there's a move to, well, we should do all the babies. You know, what happens in Africa, even if it were true, doesn't mean we should circumcise infant boys in the U.S. who are going to grow up in an entirely different environment. And if you want to get circumcised, you make the choice. I don't think we have the right to do that to a baby. Mm-hmm. We've done the same thing with female circumcision. It's interesting how the gender imbalance, it's unconstitutional to protect one gender and not the other. And yet there's denial about this too.
Mm, not allowed to circumcise baby girls.
Yeah, or even a little Nick. The American Academy of Pediatrics came out saying that was okay, and then they got blasted and had to retract it. But there's a huge difference. And people think, well, it's a lot worse for girls. Well, it isn't really. The amount of tissue that's lost in boys is far greater. The brain change, the thing is that they're infants at the time, and so you don't see what happened. But there are people who can tell the difference between intact men and circumcised men from across the room.
They can look at a man and tell whether he's been circumcised? Yeah. Or how do they tell?
Some can tell by something around their eyes or the way they use their upper lip. My sense from knowing several intact men is that there's a more gentle quality about them. Two close friends that I've stayed in touch with over the years, the only two from my residency at Johns Hopkins, I later found out just a few years ago that these two guys are intact. Mm-hmm. And I recognize this similarity in them, that it's kind of like the men in Bali, when I went to Bali. Like, these men are different. There's something more.
Oh, they're amazing.
They're more present. I don't feel that kind of competitive edge that I feel with most men.
And they'll like laugh at the drop of a hat, mm-hmm. the drop of a pin, yeah. anything. They're just ready to go into joy.
They haven't been traumatized, and it's so ubiquitous we don't even recognize it.
Well, I don't know if everyone realizes that. I mean, this started out as sort of a odd notion that came along a number of years ago, but at this point there are countries that are looking at this, and some countries now don't allow circumcision of boys.
Well, the Dutch Medical Association was the first one to come out against it. Most medical associations are on the fence. None of them recommended, mm-hmm. but none of them have come out against it until the Dutch did, and I think the Norwegians are moving in that direction, and there was a decision in Germany recently that it's considered child abuse or trauma, and there's a big furor around that. But it's a huge political issue. And
so is it now illegal in Germany?
No, I don't think it is. They're proposing that it could be, but it's just stirred up a hornet's nest.
The notion's becoming mainstream. So you're thinking that...
I mean, it's virtually unheard of in Germany anyway, because European men are almost all intact. Mm-hmm. And they're shocked when they find out what Americans do to their boys. And
So... So it might be that this warlike nature that we see of these cultures, that maybe men are just ticked off, to coin a phrase.
Yeah, it's certainly a factor. I mean, there's certainly warlike cultures that don't circumcise, but there's a definite difference, and we have to pay attention to that. In terms of studies, there's only been one study published in the BJU, in 2003, I think it was, where they took 160-some men and did a touch sensitivity. About half were circumcised and half were intact. And it's a fine touch sensitivity where you take a little plastic filament and you touch a part of the penis, in this case, until, starting with a very fine one, you can't feel, and you work up in weight and size until they can feel it. So it's a quantitative measure of sensitivity. And what they found is that the foreskin is way more sensitive, particularly the tip of it, and that the myth that Masters and Johnson promulgated in their book 40 years ago, that there was no difference. Actually, what they said, there's no difference in the sensitivity of the glands, which is about as sensitive as the heel of your foot. It's the least sensitive part of the penis, which people continue the myth that it's sensitive. It's not at all.
Right.
It's like an anvil. A surface for the foreskin to rub over. So it's the nerves in the foreskin that provide the sensation. And if they're removed, then you have this bare glands that then keratinizes, so it becomes an external organ. And it's not meant to. It's a mucous membrane. It's supposed to be. And that's why some men restore, which is stretching the skin down to cover the glands. You'll never get the nerve endings back. But just the very fact of recreating the mucous membrane, the internal organ, is a huge difference in the men that have done it. It's a pretty big commitment.
And how can people learn more about all of this, about circumcision? What's a good source?
Well, there's tons of information on the web. Intact America is the latest organization I know of that has links to all the other organizations.
And a good book?
I can't think of a single good book. There's a variety of books, but there's not a particular one that jumps out.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the people that are doing this are doing it part-time as a labor of love, whereas the people promoting circumcision have big grants and often funding behind it, a $2 billion a year industry. So it's very disorganized and haphazard. There's lots of resources on the web, though.
This is Dr. Emmett Miller. I'm here with Dr. John Travis on Conversations with Extraordinary People. And let's continue a little more along with that theme of the kinds of damage that happens to us in childhood, the way it can express ourselves in our lives and in our relationships. And looking at your just published new book, Why Dads Leave, with Maren Callender. It's called Insights and Resources for When Partners Become Parents. Why do dads leave?
Well, from personal experience, when my now 40-year-old daughter was 2.5, and we'd been in therapy, her mother and I, for 2 years, intense therapy, and concluded that we just couldn't live together. We'd come together for the wrong reasons. We had a baby to save our marriage and so forth. Was the most painful decision of my life to separate from her. And it was the same time that I was going back to California. I'd finished my residency and I was going to start the wellness center in Mill Valley, and I'd been living in Baltimore, going to Hopkins. And so this comes out of my own personal pain, this theory I call male postpartum abandonment syndrome, MPAS, M-P-A-S. And just to clarify, Maren is a woman I've been married to for 32 years. We've recently separated. And she wrote the book based on my articles and ideas that we then co-developed and turned into a book. Mm-hmm. And it's just come out. The premise is that in this culture, anyone under the age of 70 or so who were born in hospitals, who were separated at birth, who were bottle-fed, often on a schedule like I was. I got hungry after 3 hours and didn't get fed for the fourth. My mom said she hated hearing me scream, but she had to follow the book. We were made to sleep alone in cribs. We were carted around in baby buggies and things like that. We were disconnected very early. And that desire for connection fuels all the popular songs from the 50s on. It fuels our craving for connection through joining clubs. It fuels teens' pregnancies. Many of the issues in culture are based on this longing for connection and the medicating ourselves to reduce the pain. A man named James Prescott calls it somatosensory affectional deprivation syndrome, or SSAD. He did this research at NIH in the 70s and said the results are depression, violence, and addiction. And I agreed with that and would add chronic illness, fundamentalism, ecocide, materialism, and greed. And the last one, this male postpartum abandonment syndrome, which is dads leaving after the birth of a child, about 95% leave emotionally, like my dad did, because it's too painful, and about 30% leave physically. The way this works is the little boy who's disconnected grows up looking for the mommy he never had or never connected with, and if he's lucky, he finds her and marries her, and he thinks everything's okay, and then they have a baby. And then she, who probably has similar wounds, is able to heal them to some extent through the connection she has with the baby from carrying it in her body, from nursing it. She has a physical connection that men can never experience.
It soothes that pain that she has.
And if she sticks him in daycare in 3 weeks and goes back to work and there isn't that much connection, it's not as bad for the guy. But he's seeing what he didn't get. The more she meets the baby's needs, the more painful it is unconsciously for the guy, because it's re-stimulating all his childhood wounding and his birth wounding. And he's usually not aware of this, but he goes, throws himself into his work or into addictions or into depression. I got depressed after both kids were born. They were 21 years apart.
No, I think there's a lot of men that can identify with that feeling of feeling abandoned by their wife,
yeah,
and jealous,
yeah,
of the baby, and some, yeah, sometimes you have arguments, sometimes you suppress it. You may go off and, you know,
because we want to be good dads, we want to connect. The problem is, it's not the dad's fault, it's not the mom's fault, is we've destroyed the village. It takes a village to raise a child. It takes a tribe. It takes 3.87 adults per infant to adequately meet their needs, I believe. Mm-hmm. Do the math in a nuclear family or a single family. Mm-hmm. And so you've put impossible demands on parents who emotionally have a hard time surviving it, and particularly when you've got a wounded guy to begin with. But in a tribal culture or a village, it would be a non-issue. The older kids take care of the younger kids. The kids are in the center of attention. They're in the center of the village, but they're not the center of attention. We have, in response to this, thanks to John Bowlby, who developed attachment theory, and Freud got it all wrong, and with the drives and so forth. It's really about attachment and connection, and it's finally gotten its due, including a cover of Time magazine that was kind of provocative a few months ago. But William Sears popularized what Gene Liedloff first developed as the continuum concept by studying tribes of Indians in Venezuela in the rainforest. And he coined the term attachment parenting. A group of us with the Alliance for Transforming the Lives of Children took it a step further in calling it connection parenting, a book by Pam Leo as the Bible on that. And so we've started to treat babies like mammals, to meet their needs, to have them feel worthy and welcome, which is Gene Liedloff's expression. Like, how many babies don't feel worthy and welcome? Mm-hmm. And they do that through the near senses of touch, movement, and scent. Mm-hmm. Seeing things and hearing things, those are the distant senses. That doesn't mean much to a baby. It's being warm. They've been jostled around in the womb for 9 months. Suddenly they're left still in a crib, or carted around in a plastic bucket, or fed some formula that's based on cow's milk. All of these abuse, I call it normative abuse, mm-hmm, that are accepted as norms, lead to further disconnection of the baby. And if an attachment parenting addresses a lot of that, it doesn't in most cases address the village, the what you need to adequately meet the needs of the parents. And so you wind up with the dad getting depressed, withdrawing, as I did. Both times. The second time we did attachment parenting, we'd read Gene Liedloff's book. I wasn't planning to have a kid. I met Maren. We were childless for 12 or 13 years. And then we learned about attachment parenting. We thought, well, this might change the whole ball game. But it was still really hard. And because even though we were living in a community part of that time, it wasn't the kind of tribe. It was the separation. It all comes down to the separation of the Western, Northern European, mm-hmm, you know, the people who destroyed five other continents.
So the dad then becomes symptomatic and starts to act up,
yeah,
in different ways.
He withdraws. He's
and
in
he
pain.
May leave physically. He may be irritable. He may become demanding. There's skirmishes, and the wife may or may not notice the change.
She'll notice the change, but she may be, you know, she doesn't know what to do about it, and that's the hope of this book, is that we can get parents or people considering being parents to do their work, to deal with their own wounding before they plunge over this divide, because it's a huge divide.
And so they may not, the men may not leave right away, but that relationship may die several years or,
yeah,
10 years later,
yeah,
because it's there's no, the connection that made the relationship make sense is no longer there.
Yeah, it slowly erodes.
But what about if the woman goes back to work in 2 or 3 months, the way we do now?
It probably lessens it. Don't really have any data on this, but my sense is that the better that you meet the baby's needs, the more painful it is for the guy.
Mm-hmm. And so what can be done? This sounds terrible.
It is terrible, and what we need to do is recognize it first of all and do our own work so we're conscious of the pain and we can talk about it and we can get support and to band together in communities or parent support groups or co-housing or whatever. And many women are doing this often out of necessity if their husband has left or they didn't even have a husband, to share the load to some extent, but we are long ways from the traditional village community structure where mm-hmm. kids are just a natural part of it. Mm-hmm. Daycare is a non-issue. Mm-hmm. It's this whole separation that we've created. And it's part of what keeps the patriarchal system in place is we need separation. This is purposefully designed.
And the separation produces...
ability to have power over, have disposable men to send them off as cannon fodder, the whole sense of disconnection that is rampant in our culture.
It creates the anxiety that you can use to get people to buy products or mm-hmm. to join movements or armies. Or
all of these things, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge interlocking system of mm-hmm. basically disconnection that has an economic purpose. And a power, it's why 1% are controlling the world. And it's a long way from the cooperative villages of the hunter-gatherer societies.
So more connection means more cooperation, mm-hmm. means moving in a direction of more of a cooperative community.
Mm-hmm.
And that begins to take us away from that dominance model. It takes mm-hmm. us away from thinking that the world is about doing violence to get what you need.
Yeah. The power over versus power with.
So if I'm a person who is in a relationship, but, you know, we haven't had a baby or we're thinking about having a baby or we're pregnant or just had one, what could I do ahead of time? Because it's due to a wound that mm-hmm. we have. How could
become
we
aware that we're all wounded, first of all, and mm-hmm. then what are the specific wounds that I bear, and I know from studying baby pictures and some memories of my childhood, in my case, it was mostly neglect. There's abuse and neglect, and of those two, neglect is worse because there's no memories of the abuse. It's the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how a baby feels when they're left alone. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't anything deliberate. My parents were following the rules. They did the best they could do. But that was the norm in the 40s and 50s, and still too much today the norm.
Do you remember that story in the when they were beginning to raise guinea pigs in a germ-free environment, so they were performing a C-section on the pregnant mm-hmm. female and delivering the babies to turn into a germ-free environment, mm-hmm. but all the babies died.
Yeah,
all except for one of the lab technicians, and her babies all lived. So everybody came and gathered around her to see what she was doing and then how she was doing it differently. And she did it exactly like everybody else, except that after the babies were born, she took a cotton swab and stroked them with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Why are you doing that?" She said, "I don't know. I noticed that the mothers always licked the babies after they were born, mm-hmm. so I did it." And so everybody started stroking the babies and they all lived. So guinea pigs need to be stroked just even mm-hmm. to live. And mm-hmm. we as human beings with this massively sensitive brain and this incredibly wide open psyche,
mm-hmm.
We, as in Jim Prescott's movies, you see the mothers carrying their babies around, you know, that the natural mm-hmm. way that for millions of years our species has felt the closeness and the warmth and the love and the touch.
The connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim Prescott's film was called Rockabye Baby, and it was a Time Life award-winning film in 1970, and it's still a classic. You can get it online.
I met him back in the 1980s when he had been fired from NIH mm-hmm. because his studies indicated that there was all kinds of violent tendencies within the society that were probably going to erupt, and we ought to be thinking about that.
Well, and that mothers should stay home with their babies, which was not politically acceptable in the 70s.
And so they fired him for that.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. So there's something that we didn't get And often we don't know that we didn't get it because mm-hmm. it was about neglect. We were neglected in terms of we didn't get that kind of complete support, that sense of attachment, that unconditional love that we're meant to have and have had mm-hmm. since the very beginning. We've become traumatized, and that trauma shows up as a bunch of different symptoms. But really, the resolution is to try to rehabilitate that sense of connection, to find out the ways that we are critical of ourselves and destroying ourselves, that we feel helpless, or that we feel inadequate, or that we feel like there's something intrinsically flawed about us, and to go beyond those delusions and to realize that there's something valuable within us that we have to share, and to learn how to share that with other people mm-hmm. in what I would call a loving relationship, where there's care, where there's mm-hmm. affection, where there's honesty, and where there's openness, and really to learn how to love.
Yeah, there's this whole issue of connection is central, and our desires to reconnect in all the many ways. I think the DSM is a list of all the creative ways that we call mental illnesses that humans have found to try to compensate for this disconnection. Every one of them is a form of disconnection, I think. Mm-hmm. And physical illness is the same thing. They're all the creative ways that we try to make up for this mm-hmm. primary disconnection.
That this unconscious part of our mind does.
Yeah.
No one's deciding to do this.
No, it's the desire to fill the void, the empty void, and most of it's unconscious. And why the book? Because this idea of the epidemic of disappearing dads is largely not recognized. Everyone, when they stop and think about it, knows many cases of it. But it's just one of the many symptoms that Prescott said are of somatosensory affectional deprivation syndrome, or MPAS being the one that I'm focusing on, because it's a foot in the door. It's a distinct point where you're starting a new cycle with a new generation. And prevention is my interest. I think an ounce of prevention is worth 1.87 tons of cure. That Ben mm-hmm. Franklin had his numbers off a little bit. And that if you can inject if you can intervene the cycle of disconnection with the birth of a new baby and help the dad stay connected by doing his work beforehand, and along with his wife, that it's a two-way thing. They need to understand the dynamic and heal their own wounds, or be in the process of healing them. That's why I've picked that particular piece. But it's just a moment in time of a huge issue that's culture-wide, many cultures, Western cultures, and I see it's the primary hope for us as a species.
And your new book, lead author Maren Callender, and yours, the book Why Dads Leave, is something that might give us some tools for working with that.
That's my hope.
And how can people get a copy or learn more about it, or about you?
Well, the website is whydadsleave.com, and I'm not into Facebook that much, but there is a Facebook page for those who are Facebookers.
All right.
And you can even download the first chapter and read it for free.
Oh, so, great.
I think it's long Excellent. Overdue to address this issue.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Jack.
Thank you.
Now let's take a few moments and do some inner experiencing to take a moment and imagine that there is deep within you this beautiful, loving, warm, tender, empathic, juicy, sensitive self, but that often in your life, even back into your very early life, it wasn't always given the love that it needed. It wasn't always given the support, and instead there were broken connections. But that part of you is still here. And the pain that you felt at the time of those broken connections may still have stood as a wall within you. But if you're in a place where you can let your eyelids close for a moment, let your body be in a comfortable position, and take a deep breath in and let it out, let it be a feeling of letting go. Let your body relax from head to toe, as though you're standing underneath a warm shower of relaxation. Imagine that you can become as relaxed as a sleeping baby lying in its mother's arms, feeling totally safe. And be aware that at this moment in time, you are so totally safe that you can let yourself relax deeply and fully with each breath out, breathing out unnecessary tension and stress, letting the air breathe in for you, breathing in relaxation, peace, and calm. And perhaps there was a time very early in your life when there was that connection. Your mother was present, and perhaps even your father, and you were surrounded by a warm cocoon of peace and calm, protection and love. But that at a certain point you lost it. Things happened. There was disconnection around you. You didn't get to have that connection sustained as your body and your mind were designed through millions of years of evolution. And imagine that you could go back to that place in your life, as if you can ride a magic carpet back through time and feel that sense of connection. Or perhaps there are other times in your life when you felt connected, when you felt loved, when you felt joy, freedom, and satisfaction and fulfillment with someone. Go back to one of those experiences. Remember it. Picture yourself there. Maybe it was a connection with an animal or with nature. A time of peace, love, affection, of knowing that you belong. And if you can't remember a specific time, just make up a time or a movie that you've seen. But what I want you to do is to feel what it feels like to feel that love, to feel connected, loved, and loving. And as you connect with it, let go of all the unnecessary thoughts in your mind. Let go of distractions, doubts, and questions, comparisons, judgments, thoughts about the past or the future, except for an experience that can put you in touch with your ability to love. And imagine that you can love this part of yourself. And imagine that you can keep this true self with you and bring it into other relationships. Picture yourself bringing this feeling into your relationships, into your primary relationship, your connection with your kids, or with others in your life, in your community. Imagine touching with your heart, with your soul. Imagine keeping this alive in your life through your relationships, through music or poetry or nature. Realize how important it is and make a commitment. Now, how will you keep this alive in your life? Make that choice. If you're willing, choose to let yourself believe that there is a potential within you. and that by being in touch with that loving core within, you can begin to awaken that potential, or if it's already awake, to nurture it. The potential for healing, that is, to bring peace to your body so that all the organs in your body are in balance and relating properly with each other. By relaxing deeply and by remembering to visit that place, that your happy place, the safe place, the place of calm and balance within every day. Because when you're in that state, your body processes all of those stress chemicals, and you prevent and you heal those diseases that rise out of our stress or that are made worse by our stress. But when you create the inner feeling of peace, which is always available to you unless you're being physically attacked at the moment, then your body can go into its repair mode. There's no war right now. We can replenish the food. We can rebalance the system. We can calm the emotions. We can send healing to stressed out muscles. We can rebalance the internal organs and our internal microbiome. And that's a way to bring love into yourself. It's like strengthening, nurturing that network of organs and cells within you that make up your body and everything that you have here. That's a sort of internal network. How can you do that? What are the tools that are available to you that you can use on a regular basis to keep yourself on course? You know where you want to go. What is it that you need to do? Think of three specific things now, that if you followed through and did each of these things, you'd really be certain to bring more of this love, this balance, and this healing into your life. Good. Aware of those three things now? Now, you can make a commitment to them right now, an honest commitment. Not a, oh yeah, I'll try to get to it, or I'll call you sometime, or oh yeah, I gotta get around. No. Make a commitment to have a sincere intention to do those three things, or two of them, or just one. Are you willing to do that? And if so, do it now. There. Good. That's all it takes. And now there's a second network, and that's the network that surrounds you. When you use that quality of love to balance the internal functioning of the cells and organs of your body, then you create an internal healthy state. And an internal healthy state is not one that's defensive or angry or anxious or depressed or resentful or lustful or jealous or envious, because those states all mean that you're creating the notion of me and you, or us and them. And then you build up a tension between these two supposedly different things. They're not really different. They're the same. And so you're injecting anger in there. Just confuses the whole system. That's the old paradigm. That's the anger, me versus you, right versus wrong, either or. Now we're talking about both and. A higher level of consciousness that sees that what holds us together is much more important than that which divides us. There's an old story about all the different organs of the body got into a fight with each other. And the mouth was angry at the stomach, so it wouldn't chew up food. And the feet were angry at the hands, and so it wouldn't take them to where the food was very efficiently. And there was just an awfully big struggle inside. And as the story goes, the anus looked up at all of this and became very disgusted and said to itself, says, this has to stop, all of this fighting. And so it tightened itself up so tight that no feces could get through at all. So pretty soon it kind of built up, and the toxins began to build up in the large bowel and seep out into the system. And soon the shoulders and arms were too weak to really hardly move, and the eyes were too blurry to see, and the ears forgot all about their argument with the tongue, and they said, wait, stop, please, turn it off. And the little anus looked up and says, okay, but only if you guys will stop fighting. And so all the organs of the body made peace with each other so that the body could function smoothly after that. And the anus opened up, the feces were relieved, and it's a wonderful story. And the moral, of course, is you don't have to be an asshole to be a boss, but sometimes it helps. When we can let all the organs of our bodies come into harmony within us, there's internal health. Now there's our opportunity to come into harmony with the people around us, to think about those who are closest to us. Where is their anger? Where are their withholds? Where is their manipulation? Where is their anxiety? Where are their threats? Where's their mistrust? Oh, your relationships could be so much better if you really believed in love. If you really believe that what holds us together is so much more valuable than those little things that seem to separate us, that if we simply focus on what we have together and feel the love and the richness and the power and the potential that comes from our serving each other, each of us bringing our own unique strengths and talents and purposes and skills and gifts, and contributing it to the whole, not judging, not criticizing, not fighting for more, but everyone willing to go 75% of the way. Imagine that. And imagine that you take that out into your friendships and into your work relationships with all the individuals and groups that you connect with, that you bring that quality of love. And imagine that you create a network, or that you join a network in the world around you, a powerful network, a network that can rise to the level of being able to take over control of the globalized economic system. In other words, that we create a neocortex for that subconscious mind that is the computer network all around the planet, as if each of us is like a nerve cell that connects with another person who's another nerve cell, and each of us all together in our thinking make up this global network, and imagine love flowing into that network and being distributed by every person and every machine, and see what happens. And until next time, thanks so much for being with us. Be sure to visit us at drmiller.com, and remember, until next time, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com. Locate your desired program, and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the DrMiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.